Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how do you know that designer handbag you have is real? And an Arizona opera singer on coming home to perform. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
And I know that Arizonans have been concerned about the president's age. And since the debate, I think those concerns are even more top of mind. And I think the president has a lot to do to assure Arizonans and Americans. And I know that he knows that that is his job over the coming weeks.
I think he, should, be out there and campaigning and, showing the contrast between him and his opponent.
What the single subject rule says is they have a right to do them separately. You can't make them choose. You can't say, if you want to regulate fentanyl this way, you've got to regulate library cards this way.
So the fact that the description actually uses both phrases in different sections, to me, seems very fair and balanced.
That's why we filed this lawsuit today, to hold politicians to account and ensure that Arizona voters receive an impartial summary of our measure in the publicity pamphlet, instead of one that uses a politically charged phrase embraced by our opponents.
We're going to really put our best foot forward and be as diplomatic as possible, because this is about life. This is about the future. This is about our children. And we got to tell the story of the pain, the struggle that people continue to go through.
And with me to talk about a pair of members of Congress from Arizona calling on President Biden to step aside, a lawsuit filed over the description of a ballot measure this November, and more, are Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Good morning, Barrett.
Good morning.
And attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
All right. So, Roy, let me start with you on this, and we will make the disclosure that you are working on the Biden campaign as one of their attorneys, yeah?
Correct.
Here in Arizona. So I have to ask, I mean, there have been calls from nearly two dozen members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, including Arizona's Raul Grijalva and then yesterday Greg Stanton, calling on President Biden to stand down as nominee for the Democratic Party. He has said he won't do it, including yesterday at his news conference in NATO. I'm just curious what you make of this number of elected Democrats saying that the president shouldn't continue to try to be president.
Well, I'm not in Stanton's camp or Grijalva's camp. I just saw the statement like everyone else. And to the extent that their reasoning here is some form of electability argument, this idea that maybe Biden can't win and that's why, I would point them to even this morning's NPR poll that has Biden up by two nationally. If you look at the 538 model, he's still the favorite in beating Trump. It's always going to be and always, we always predicted that this was going to be a very, very close race. But it is clear that the numbers haven't really fundamentally changed much from that bad debate night, which means that President Biden, can still win, still has a path to victory. What I do believe, no matter what, is that Democrats are going to be united around one thing, which is preventing Donald Trump from getting back into the Oval Office, because I think we all understand not only the bad things that would happen policy-wise if Donald Trump came back, like the Project 2025 stuff, for example, but also with this U.S. Supreme Court giving the ability of the president to do essentially whatever he wants or she wants without any kind of accountability with immunity, I think that's going to be the imperative that Democrats are going to have. So no matter what happens, we're going to have a convention in a few weeks. I think we're all going to be united against Donald Trump.
Is that idea of being united, does it become more difficult, though, when you have people like Greg Stanton, like Peter, one of the senators from Vermont, basically saying that, you're going to watch Joe Biden presumably accept the nomination when you have this number of people saying he shouldn't be accepting the nomination?
Well, I think, the president himself has said a number of times, like, it was a very bad night, that debate night, right? And we have even seen the president's senior advisors, people like Ron Klain, saying, like, hey, he's got to go out there and show that he can do this. We've even had, you heard the clip from Governor Hobbs, mm-hmm. and Ruben Gallego said the same thing. So I think everyone understands that. I think the president understands that. Even last night, again, he sort of committed to, like, I have to go do that. I have to run the campaign that is necessary to win, and then I'm committed to serving another 4 years, and I have to show I can do that. So if he does that, I think we're going to be in a good position still. And that's what's going to be played out over the next few weeks as he goes back on the campaign trail and continues these kinds of things. He's got a couple of interviews coming up this week. And so if those things go well, and I think they will, then I think we're all going to be in a position where we're still united.
Barrett, I don't want to read too much into facial expressions, but you look a little skeptical.
Well, first of all, you know, for those of you in Radioland, Roy has now taken a swig from what is allegedly coffee, but I think is whiskey, to dull the pain. You know, look, I agree that Democrats are going to be mostly united, but Republicans are also mostly united. And so it's the people in the middle. And I don't think Roy can argue that Arizona, which was only 4 years ago, went for Biden, is almost out of reach now for his team. I don't know that Joe Biden can win Arizona anymore, especially after that debate. So while Biden may be up in a national poll, as we all know at this table, and your smart listeners know, national polls is not we don't have a national election, right? We have really 50 state elections. And I have not seen in those swing states that will decide this election any positive movement for Joe Biden.
Is it possible, Barrett, do you think, for Biden to regain that? Or like it's either he stays the nominee and Trump wins or somebody else becomes the nominee and we see what happens?
Yeah. Look, anything is possible. I mean, the election is still, you know, 115 or whatever days away. Oh, my God. Anything is possible, especially given these two candidates. We don't know what Donald Trump will say, you know, day in and day out, you know, and his criminal trials and, I mean, just everything. So, I mean, so much can change.
Yeah.
But not least of which, everyone's asking, will Biden be the eventual nominee? And, you know, he keeps saying this is a settled issue. Yet, you know, you hear people like Nancy Pelosi saying, well, this is a question for Joe Biden that he alone can answer. He has answered it. So, you know, every day we see more and more people, more and more elected Democrats come out. It's not just the George Clooney, the Hollywood people of the world, but I think I heard today the New York Times reported that there's $90 million on the sidelines right now of pledged money to the Democratic organizations that support Joe Biden. And that's going to sit on the sidelines for a little bit. That's not an insignificant amount of change. And so I don't know when it has to be decided by, but I really think this is an unsettled question going into the Republican National Convention next week.
So, Roy, regardless of what President Biden decides, what are you hearing and maybe what do other Democrats in Arizona have to do? Like, what is their strategy? Because all of this is swirling, fairly or unfairly, rightly or wrongly, whatever the president decides to do. What do Arizona Democrats need to do, for example? What does Ruben Gallego need to do? What do Democrats trying to win control of the state legislature, what do they have to do amid sort of this big situation at the top of the ticket?
Well, I think, you know, part of the answer is also a bit of a response to my friend Barrett saying that Arizona is not reachable, is not winnable for the Democrats. I disagree with that fundamentally. And the reason why, there's a couple of reasons. But the first is that President Biden, I think in my mind, it's unquestioned that he has had a very successful 3.5 years as president. When you look at how well the economy is, I mean, this country has rebounded from the COVID pandemic better than any other country in the world, economically speaking. When you think about where we are in his accomplishments on foreign policy, reviving the NATO alliance, which is very, you know, relevant to yesterday's conference, you know, I think there's a lot of successes to run on. And Democrats in general, I think, are going to have to tout those successes, particularly in a state like Arizona, where the economy is doing very well. And I think a lot of it is because of the policies that this president has promulgated. And then I would also say the other thing that gives me hope or confidence is Arizona has rejected Trumpism for a number of election cycles in a row. This is not a place that has rewarded, since 2018, Trump or Trump-like candidates. And I think there's a reason for that. I think the chaos of that is something that, you know, fundamentally, particularly independents in Arizona and Democrats do not want. And that also gives me, I think, a lot of confidence that this is going to be tight no matter what, right? I mean, Arizona is always tight at the statewide level, but the Democrats can still win and will win. And if you're, Ruben Gallego, obviously, I mean, you're doing very well. And I think it's continuing to, again, talk about the accomplishments that the Democrats have done and will do in a second Biden term. And then, of course, with Rubin, I mean, obviously, you know, his biography and some of the other, you know, things that he's done in his life, I think are very, very appealing to voters as a combat veteran, and he will continue to do that. I know Governor Hobbs will continue to tout at the legislative level what she can do with a Democratic majority when it comes to addressing some of their major priorities.
I am going to be fascinated to meet the Trump Gallego voter.
But according to the polls, there seem to be a lot of them, right?
When the media starts interviewing them, I'm going to be fascinated to see the schizophrenia in that voter. I think that's going to be an incredible thing to watch. I mean, I will say, look, one thing I very much agree with Roy on is, you know, Trump has yet to get 50% in Arizona. Even when he won the state in 2016, he did not cross the 50% threshold. So certainly he has an uphill climb, but you know, I can acknowledge that the economy is going well, but I think Biden and Democrats have to acknowledge that people aren't feeling that the economy is going well. Gas prices are inching again toward $4. I mean, it's always more expensive in the summer. If it crosses that four and heads up to 4.5 in the fall, that's going to be a problem for Democrats and Joe Biden in Arizona. So yeah, the economy is doing better, and I think people will vote on that. But, you know, it's 7% interest rates to buy a home or buy a car. You know, gas at $4. Egg prices still at $4 a dozen. I mean, I just think that those are the things that people will look at in deciding who to vote for, and that's a problem for the Democrats.
All right. So before we go to break, I want to ask you guys about a court hearing from earlier this week about the border security proposal that legislative Republicans are trying to send to the ballot. This was sued over what's called the single subject rule, basically saying that because it deals with border security, maybe a provision, for example, about fentanyl sale and distribution shouldn't be in there, and that violates the clause. Barrett, what did you make of that hearing? And obviously, this is going to get appealed. So ultimately, do you think this still stays on the ballot?
Look, I don't have one of them fancy law degrees like Roy Herrera does, but I do think there is an issue in the single subject realm. And Corey Langhofer, the attorney for the legislature, tried to make the argument that it all revolves around, you know, crossing the border illegally, whether it's drugs or people, and which is, I think, an innovative argument and held maybe a little bit of sway with the judge, but there were still some issues. So it is a little bit of it appears on its face to be a little bit of a log rolling by the legislature here, dealing with several different things at once. I will say if this survives, it probably passes with 60%, and it may never, ever go into effect. But voters will tell the legislature, will tell the federal government they want something done. I don't know that it'll see the light of the ballot, though.
Yeah, the effect going into effect part relies on Texas's SB4. There's a certain amount of time after which that goes into effect that this would if it passes. Roy, you are the lawyer in the room. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see a log rolling issue here?
Yeah, there's definitely an issue. I mean, you know, these cases, single subject cases, are difficult to win, just generally speaking. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's some very skilled litigators involved on both sides here, and I do think there's an issue. I mean, the legislators seem to sort of argue that this is all related to quote unquote trafficking, which is sort of a pretty nebulous term, right? Creative, but nebulous. And so they're going to rely upon that. You know, if I had to bet, I think they probably will be successful and this will remain on the ballot. I don't hope that.
The Republicans
will be successful. I don't hope that, of course, because I don't want to see it on the ballot. And I also don't want to see it in the ballot because, and this gets to Barrett's comment, to me, this was all a cynical political ploy by the Republicans in the legislature in trying to put anything immigration related on the ballot because they think that is favorable to them politically. I don't think this was about at any point ever actually doing anything about immigration. I think if Republicans wanted to do something about immigration, then they should have pushed their congressional counterparts to get an immigration deal done, which was negotiated by Republicans and Democrats and supported by President Biden. But they didn't do that. And so I don't think that that is what this is really about.
Wait, Roy, are you saying politicians are playing politics? Lottie, Lottie.
Sadly, yes, Brad.
Shocking, shocking. All right. That is Roy Herrera. I'm also joined by Barrett Marson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Roy, let me start with you on a lawsuit filed over the description that will be in the publicity pamphlet. We all get these mailed, registered voters anyway, get these mailed to our homes that have a little description of what who the candidates are, what the ballot propositions are. This was over a debate over the language used to describe the abortion initiative. And the supporters of this initiative are saying Republicans on this committee put language into the proposal that is political and what they say is not accurate.
Right. I mean, because legally speaking, the description is supposed to be objective, right? And so the idea is it an objective description of what the initiative would do? And of course, the proponents of the initiative would say, no, I would agree with them that this is another example. I mean, maybe this is the theme of the day of politicians being politicians, but the Republican majority on that committee deciding, you know, hey, we're going to inject some politics here and including what they think is a politically favorable term in that description to try to kill the initiative at the ballot box. And that's clearly what this is. What gives me hope, one, is I think there's a good legal argument, so perhaps the description gets changed. But then two, even if it doesn't, I think this is going to pass with overwhelming numbers because of what I think Arizonans' feelings are about reproductive rights.
Is this the kind of thing, Barrow, give me 1 second. Is this the kind of thing that a judge, like we sometimes hear judges, for example, are like loath to remove candidates or to do stuff like that. Is this the kind of issue that a judge might be reluctant to involve themselves in?
Well, we have seen in the past these kinds of lawsuits work, meaning judges have ordered changes. And so I don't view it the same way because I do think the judges will see, you know, if something is not, objective at all and clearly charged language inserted for a reason that's inaccurate. So like this is an example where I could see a judge definitely thinking that and therefore ordering that terminology gets removed. So I think there's a very good chance that this is successful.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure that I entirely agree with Roy on that part. I mean, I'm not sure that there is a big difference between unborn human and fetus. I will say that I don't think it matters a whit. I think just like the immigration one, this will pass with more than 60%. So I don't know that the description, one word in the description is going to make any difference whatsoever. There's going to be a robust campaign, robust pro-side campaign to pass this. I think it passes easy. And, the legislature couldn't put a competing referral onto the ballot.
There's talk of it.
There was talk of it. They just didn't have the votes because there were a lot of Republicans who did not want to enshrine any kind of abortion in the state constitution. So I think this is a really small argument in a big pond that is going to fill up with votes for it in November.
All right, guys, let's talk about a congressional race that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about. This is the first congressional district. David Schweikert, a Republican, is the incumbent, has been there for several terms. Barrett, there's a new poll this week. There's a number of Democrats running for the right to take him on, and it basically shows that there are three candidates sort of in the top tier. We have Andre Cherney, Marlene Galland Woods, and Amish Shah, basically statistically tied, but 35%, this poll found, are undecided. Early voting is underway, and the primary is, what, 3 weeks away now?
Yeah. Look, I think half of your listeners today are running in that district.
Hopefully we have a few more listeners than that.
Yeah, it is a crowded field, and it is a pretty harsh primary, not nearly as bad as, say, CD8 in the West Valley between Abe Hameda and Blake Masters, but I would say this is a pretty active primary, and this is going to be one of the most competitive districts in the entire nation come November. So I'm actually surprised there isn't more attention being paid to this Democratic primary, which is going to be lead to a November election that is going to be a very expensive campaign.
Right. So, Roy, I mean, this is, as Barrett said, this is one of Democrats' top pickup opportunities. They see it that way anyway in terms of trying to take back the House. Is it in any way surprising to you that as early voting is underway, this many voters in that district don't know who they're supporting?
Not really, because I don't think this is something that you see in a lot of districts and a lot of primaries where there's a good number of undecideds. And so everything really depends on turnout and how the respective campaigns execute in the final weeks. It's the summertime in Arizona. There's a lot of stuff going on where people, I think, are now paying more close attention. So I'm not particularly surprised by that. And I also don't think that just because, you know, there are undecideds in this polling that sort of indicates that there's a lack of interest, because to Barrett's point, I mean, this is going to be one of the closest and maybe one of the most expensive congressional general elections that we're going to have in the country. I mean, I think David Schweikert won by 0.1% or something last time around. So whatever Democrat comes out of that primary, they're going to get a lot of national support, I think, from Democrats. And, of course, themselves will be raising a lot of money.
And remember, Mark, you know, the primary was moved up a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's 100 and, oh, my God, degrees outside. And, you know, people are more concerned about the pool, the electric bill, and maybe getting to San Diego or L.A. for a few days. And so, you know, their ballots are sitting in their office, their kitchen table, or, you know, in the den or something. And they'll get to it soon, eventually. And then they'll start doing some Googling and whatnot.
Barrett, if you are David Schweikert and his campaign, is there a candidate that you would be most concerned about facing?
Well, I think from that perspective, probably the candidate he most wants to face is maybe Andre Cherney, who has that DOJ investigation hanging over him. So I think that's the one that he would angle for. And, you know, he probably doesn't want to go against a woman with abortion as an issue as well, and probably doesn't want to go against someone who's well-funded like Conor O'Callaghan. So, I mean, there are people there he probably doesn't want to face as much as maybe, say, Andre Cherney.
Roy, you talked about Democrats at the national level being united around President Biden. Do you get the sense that once the votes are tallied and there is a nominee, that the other, five candidates will rally around that? Or are there maybe some wounds that will be tough to heal?
I don't think so. I think everyone will unite around the nominee, again, because of how important it is. You know, flipping the House of Representatives in D.C. is a, you know, massively important thing for the Democrats. And again, you know, it's going to run through this district and, of course, the one down in Tucson. So I think everyone is going to be united. I mean, my personal preference in that race is to not nominate a former Republican in that race. So that probably tells you who I'm leaning towards. But you know, I think no matter what happens, all the Democrats are going to come together against David Schweikert. And I think David Schweikert has significant weaknesses as well. I mean, he's had his own scandals in the past that I think that'll be
Absolutely.
Pointed out to. And it's also a district that, you know, I think, again, if things are going well at the presidential level, at the Senate level, the Democrats will be winning that district. So it's basically going to require Schweikert to outperform Trump in his own district.
But to bring it around to the original conversation, look at how many Democrats are coming out both publicly and privately talking about the down ballot problems that Joe Biden creates.
Mm.
And if Joe Biden remains the top of the ticket, that helps Schweikert. That helps Sisqaamani down in Tucson. I mean, you know, Joe Biden is probably wants Sisqaamani's best friend right now.
Are these the kinds of races, for example, the Sisqaamani race, the Schweikert race, that people are talking about when they discuss the down ballot, potential down ballot effect?
100%. I mean, look, I don't know that there's anything Carrie Lake can do to win. So I don't think Ruben Gallego has a problem there. But I definitely think, someone like Juan Sisqaamani is going to benefit if Joe Biden remains at the top of the ticket.
All right, Barrett, just about 45 seconds left. Carrie Lake will be speaking at the RNC next week. What do you think she's going to say?
I don't know. I mean, what? Does she get a 3 p.m. Slot?
I'm not sure about the day and the time.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the day and the time. But, the voters that she's going to talk to, they're already in her camp. As has been the problem with Carrie Lake over the last couple of years, she is not expanding her base one bit. And that just remains a multi-cycle problem for her.
Roy, care to weigh in on what she might have to say?
No, but I, you know, as a Democrat, I'm perfectly happy with her speaking at the RNC convention because, you know, she, to Barrett's point, has shown no discipline as far as like wanting to moderate her messaging at all. And so I know she's going to go up there and give the red meat and say something crazy. And that's only going to benefit Ruben Gallego, I think. So I'm perfectly fine with her doing that.
And also just one last thing. Where's Carrie Lake lately otherwise? I mean, here's the problem with Carrie Lake and sort of her campaign is that, you know, they don't. The local media doesn't cover every jot and tittle of a campaign like maybe 20 or 30 years ago. So she hasn't been on TV or on the radio or in the newspaper very much except for, you know, some negative stuff, right?
Interesting.
And so I think that's been a problem.
All right. That is Barrett Marson, Roy Herrera. Thanks you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an opera performer who got his start with the Phoenix Boys Choir. But first, let's take a few minutes to dive deep into the world of handbags. And we don't just mean any old bag you can buy at a department store. We mean designer handbags. Think Louis Vuitton, Hermes, Chanel, and of course the mother lode, the Birkin bag. To learn more about this, my co-host Lauren Gilger visited the owner of a local shop in Old Town Scottsdale that specializes in designer bags and the resale of them. Sydney, no last name, doesn't do consignment, but buys every bag up front for resale. And that means she needs to be absolutely sure that what she's buying is real. And by real, we don't mean it's an actual handbag made out of leather. Nope, it's much more complicated than that. Here's her conversation with Lord and how it all started out with a client who needed some money and fast.
I had a client who was in financial distress, like blew through her trust fund money and was like, called me and said, I really need to sell this handbag. Like, I got to pay my electrical bill. And I was like, okay, let me see if I can help her out. So she's like, it's in pristine condition. It's fantastic. So I meet her in a parking lot at a local consignment store where she pulled it out of because they couldn't sell it. And she hands over the bag and I hand over the money. Amateur move, didn't look at the bag. She drives off. I open up this dust bag and I'm like, what is this? This thing looks like it's been run over by a truck. So I have two options here, right? I call her back and say, give me my money and this thing is not what I thought it was. Or I do a good deed and hope for the best. Long of the short, I put it online, sold it, and made like $200. And I was like, huh, light bulb went off. So I'm forever grateful for this person because it created the beast that this is.
Even though it was kind of a mess of a bag.
Exactly. So this created the beast of the day. So it all worked out, and that's how life is sometimes. Yeah. And I realized there's the niche.
I mean, obviously you saw a market in the consignment world and like a missing piece there. But also just like for people who have no idea what we're talking about when we're talking about a Birkin bag or Chanel or whatever, like explain the demand and sort of the rise in demand that we've seen for these kind of luxury and designer bags in particular in the last decade or so since you've been doing this?
So they're great investments. People have noticed over the years that these things obtain value. Mm. They're holding their value. So when you buy a bag that's like a non-branded bag, let's just say from a major department store, Dillard's, Macy's or whatever, not a recognizable brand, and you pay $200-$300, when you're done with that in a couple of years, it's really valueless. I mean, you know, maybe a sentimental value to you or whatever. You like the craftsmanship of it. But these brands are really demanding their price point. And, you know, so if someone bought something 5-6 years ago, it's most likely went up in retail, especially with I mean, what hasn't went up in the last 2-3 years? So if you're taking care of them, if you're wearing them with care, you're leather conditioning them, you're not, you know, destroying the bag. People think sometimes just because it's Louis Vuitton, it's bulletproof. You know, that's not the case. But if you're really taking care of your product, it's going to obtain its value, which is nice. So then, you know, when you're done with it and it's in decent shape, you're able to get something for it and you're able to put it towards the next piece or you're able to move on to whatever else you're collecting. So people really appreciate that. And, you know, they become family heirlooms. It's the new tennis bracelet, they say. So the Birkin bag is a new tennis bracelet, meaning, you know, moms are now passing them down to their daughters on their wedding days or grandmothers.
So interesting. And it's like a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide. But there's also a fake side of this that you're watching out for and we want to talk a little bit about too. Tell us about just first of all, how good these fakes can be.
Yeah, so they can be really bad too. So there's a thing called super fakes and they are super expensive too, but they're obviously mimicking a bag that's going to retail $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. You're still paying a couple thousand dollars for it. With that being said, if you know what you're doing, it shouldn't be that difficult, but there is, you know, super fakes out there that are a little bit more challenging. So we pride ourselves in authentication. We have an in-house authentication team and also use a third party non-biased opinion in our purchasing. So we really stand behind what we're selling here at Lovelux. But you know, there is some things that you can look out for, but the fashion industry is always, in my opinion, a couple steps ahead. So when they see that these people are catching on to what they're doing, they're on to the next, So they're giving them a little bit of a challenge, these copiers per se, a run for their money, which I'm very thankful for because unfortunately, you know, although people think they're just getting a bag that looks like a Louis Vuitton and, you know, getting a steal of the day, it's a really dirty industry. There's a lot into it, children trafficking and labor, and it's not a very pretty thing. So besides not only just stealing from the brand itself, it's not something that I personally would want to carry because there's a lot more into it besides just getting a Louis Vuitton quote bag for $100.
Okay, so show us how you do this because this is a very in-depth and, like you said, like multi-level process to make sure the bags you're buying are real.
Yeah. So back in the day, we're going to use Louis Vuitton for an example because it's probably one of our number one selling brands. So date codes and authentication cards is a big part of this. Louis Vuitton does not have authentication cards. People always come in here and are like, does this come with an authentication card? So that's what people like deemed as what was authentic. But they have date codes. They did have date codes. So that means that it's two letters typically followed by four numbers that says what factory the product was made in, what year, and what month. Mm. So this was kind of like their log to kind of control or show where this product was made. Now, of course, anyone can make up two letters and followed by four numbers. So they realized that you could just copy that. So now they do microchips. They started that in 2021. So it's not something that you physically see. Mm. We have a scanner that's going to scan and pick up that microchip.
So it's like hidden in the bag somewhere?
Hidden in the bag. You can't see it to like the naked eye. For Louis Vuitton, that's what they've switched off to do. But you can even tell with the, and I'll gladly show you here a date code, the print, the lettering. They don't miss a mark with Louis Vuitton. You know, a lot of things are handcrafted. It goes through a lot of inspection process, which also is the reason it costs so much. You know, these aren't just made by machines and pumped out. A lot of it's handmade. There's a lot of artistry. It goes through a lot of steps to get to the final product. Mm-hmm. So you can just see by the stitching, the coloring, they just don't miss a mark. You know, there's no loose threads. Sometimes this threading here is like bright neon yellow. This is like super candy apple red. A lot of times in fakes, this red coloring here will be dripped down or, you know, and the pressing of letters. It just isn't to the craftsmanship of Louis Vuitton. So from afar, squinting, with sunglasses on and a few drinks in, maybe it looks real. But when you really look close, you can, if you know what you're doing, you can tell the real deal.
Do you get a lot of people coming in and trying to sell you fake bags? Or do you think they even know sometimes?
I would say the answer is no, they don't. Because I think that if someone's trying to like pull a scam and they look at what we do here, no. Some people, unfortunately, not knowing that once in a while happens, and we have to kind of like, we don't ever say something's not authentic. We offer an authentication service, you know, but when you have to like, you know, kind of cushion the wording and stuff, it's unfortunate. But for the scammers out there, we have a long process when you come in store. It's very detailed. We ask for your driver's license. We only pay out for bags via check. Mm-hmm. So typically those people that are looking to make a quick buck don't come here, and we are thankful for that.
So last question for you then. Tell us, you know, what do you love about this? Like, is there a bag that you love and will, you know, buy every time you get it?
You know, it's funny. People always ask me that. Do you steal like all the bags? And I'm like, well, technically it's not stealing because I own them. But there's something about it I love for my clients to get them too. I'm a big Hermes fan myself. So when the orange box comes in here, we all start jeweling. So I love their Hermes Evelyn bag. 95% of people that are listening to this are like, what is an Evelyn bag? Go Google it. It's really cool. But you know, what I really love about this is the community and like being able to, you know, grow this business so that we are able to donate bags to certain charities. And there's more than it just like a very like vain, superficial industry. There's a lot, you hear people's stories of how they were able to collect these. And I've seen people at their lowest points in life that have to sell things that, you know, went through really tragic things and lost family members or so be it. Mm-hmm. And then seeing that person, you know, rise out of that and be on the other side and come back and shop or, you know, you sell more bags. So I really value and appreciate the community we've built here. And to me, I know it just seems like, you know, another little retail store, but it's my world. It's my life. And I'm really fortunate to be on the journey. I've buckled up and I'm here for it.
Sydney, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again for giving us this opportunity to teach you a little bit about bags.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Opera singer Armando Contreras was raised in Phoenix and still lives in the West. The baritone has performed at the prestigious Glimmer Glass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, as well as with opera companies around the country. This past fall, he came home for a performance at Gamage Auditorium in a production of The Old Man and the Sea. Earlier this year, I spoke with Contreras about his career, singing in front of a hometown audience, and how he got into opera in the first place.
Oh.
That is the voice of opera singer Armando Contreras. The baritone was raised in Phoenix and still lives in the West. He's performed at the prestigious Glimmerglass Festival in Cooperstown, New York, as well as with opera companies around the country. This past fall, he came home for a performance at Gamage Auditorium in a production of The Old Man and the Sea. I caught up with Contreras recently to talk about his career and singing in front of a hometown audience, but we started with how he got into opera in the first place.
Yeah. I was in the Phoenix Boys Choir. I was in the Phoenix Boys Choir for 8 years, and I was in two productions with Arizona Opera in the children's chorus of those operas. So I was in Carmen and I was in La Boheme. And from the beginning, I was probably 9 years old at that point, and I had already loved opera, just being in it. I thought it was so thrilling. Even though I didn't know what they were saying or what I was saying, it was just so fun to be on stage. So I knew at that point that it was something that I wanted to always do. And I had always been singing around the house as well. And then in high school, my voice changed and changed for the worst. So definitely kind of lost interest the first couple years of high school. Then there was an audition opening up my junior year to sing with Phoenix Opera, which is just a smaller company than Arizona Opera. And they were doing Aida, and they needed some more chorus members. So I auditioned for it and got in. And then my love for opera was reignited, and I just had so much fun being on stage. It's such a thrill to be on stage when people are singing beautifully, but also at the top of their lungs. So after that, then I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music for my undergraduate degree. Then I got my master's degree and my honor certificate degree at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, and then had been working some internships with some opera companies, doing some smaller roles. And now I have representation in New York, and I kind of travel all over the place and was lucky enough to come back home.
Yeah. Well, so what about opera specifically does it for you? Because, like, if you like being on stage with singing, there's a lot of different things you can do. I would imagine, like, a lot of 9-year-old boys are not super into opera.
I had this conversation the other day with a colleague of mine that actually specializes in musical theater, and I think musical theater has pretty similar traits. But for me, opera without amplification, although now opera actually does have a lot of amplification, but when I started, you know, there wasn't a lot of amplification. And for a singer to be singing so viscerally, so much emotion in opera, right? We see everything from love to anger, to crying, to hate, all these different things. And that the voice can express all those things so beautifully in its, you know, purest form. I think that's what brought me to opera, because like a rock singer can do that too, right? But, you know, a rock singer has, you know, the microphone, there's just so much happening around them.
Yeah.
Where opera singing is just, we've gotten the voice to just this, you know, beautiful pedagogical place that can just do so much. And I've always found it so impressive and so mysterious. And I still find it very mysterious. And it just, it always drew me.
Do you understand now what you're singing?
If I tell you no, then I'm going to get in trouble with all my conductors and all my directors.
So we'll go with yes.
I do now. And actually, the one we just did in Arizona wasn't English, so that helps out. But now I always translate it. And in fact, in school, I took French, I took Italian, I took German, not only the languages, but also how to pronounce them. So I took additional classes in diction class to make sure I'm doing it right in case there's a German speaker, Italian, or French speaker in the audience.
Interesting. So you were just back in Phoenix to perform in a production of Old Man and the Sea. What was it like taking that story, turning it into opera, and performing it in your hometown?
Yeah, I think what's great about this production is that your expectation with the book is going to be so different for what it actually is on stage. So the book itself, right, it's very brief and concise, but there's a lot of emotions and there's just a lot of detail inside of, you know, only 50 page book. And in this production, we had this great director, Carmina Silic from Slovenia, who took the concept of Old Man in the Sea and really made it very abstract, very avant-garde, very nuanced and minimal. So instead of, you know, me being in a boat, I was actually walking on a treadmill. it was such a unique experience, but But the core of it, doing it on stage, was really to amplify the emotions of the old man. And Paola Prestini, who was the composer of this work, Paola also put in the life of Ernest Hemingway, so that the life of Ernest Hemingway is kind of juxtaposed to Santiago, and kind of seeing all the pain that Ernest Hemingway had to go through in his life. And it's just this big emotional journey that I know people, you know, do not expect when they go in. Going back home was great. I got to stay with my parents. I have a one-year-old son named Theo, and we live in Colorado with my wife, Logan. So it was nice to come home. My mom got to see Theo dad, and my whole family was there. Some colleagues from the Phoenix Boys Choir, too. I also went to Brophy College Prep, so it was nice to see some people. I was actually able to work with them one of the mornings. So yeah, it's great to have family. It makes you feel so comfortable when you're on stage, because it's just a really proud moment. I got to sing a lead role at the Gamut. I just never, you know, who would have thought that I'd come back to do that? So
yeah,
a lot of fun. So happy to be back home.
I'll bet. So I'm wondering if you see a performance, a show like this, like Old Man and the Sea, like, do you see that as a way to maybe broaden opera's audience to maybe folks who are not quote unquote traditional opera fans, or maybe don't know a lot about the genre, but maybe know this story and come to see it and maybe get hooked on hearing opera?
Oh, yeah. This opera and opera being written today is nothing like what people may think opera is, right? We may think of opera like Carmen, La Boheme, and these very traditional stories. And even though Old Man and the Sea is a traditional story in American literature, the way that it is presented is just so nuanced. It's so contemporary. It's so minimal that people that enjoy that in other facets of art, I think they'll really enjoy this opera, and their concept of opera is just going to absolutely change, just like it's changing in the industry in America.
Is there a role that you have not yet had a chance to play that you are just dying to play?
Oh, boy. Well, we can be here for another hour there. Let's see. I'll think of one traditional and one contemporary. So traditional, I haven't done Don Giovanni yet by Mozart. And that's a really fun role. Don Giovanni's not a good guy. And sometimes I like to play the bad guy, because I like to be a good guy in real life. So playing a bad guy on stage is kind of fun.
Okay.
So I would love to do Don Giovanni. Let's see, a contemporary role that I haven't done. I think Dead Man Walking is a great Joseph Desrochers in Dead Man Walking, which is being premiered at the Metropolitan Opera. People might be familiar with Sister Helen Prejean's book, Dead Man Walking, also the movie with Sean Penn. He's in the movie.
Yeah.
That's a really important story that's being told right now at the Met. So that would also be a really cool role to do.
Yeah, those are two pretty different roles. My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
Baritones get to do some pretty cool stuff, I think, in opera.
Yeah, I it sounds that way. All right, Armando Contreras, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Have a good day.
With fewer movies being produced during last year's writer's strike, there's been a return of older classics to the big screen, from Steel Magnolias to old Spider-Man movies to Shrek. And here on the show, we've talked about how many movies coming out this summer are steeped in nostalgia. A new film series from the city of Peoria combines these two phenomena with an Arizona twist. Richard Schultz is the program coordinator for the Made in Arizona film series and says he's most excited for this month's film.
Our next film in July is Lilies of the Field, which is a 1963 film starring Sidney Poitier. And even though this film is over 60 years old right now, it really feels current. It feels contemporary.
Sidney Poitier won an Academy Award for Best Actor for his performance in Lilies of the Field. He plays a traveling handyman who takes on repair projects for a group of German Roman Catholic nuns he encounters in rural Arizona. Eventually, they ask him to build a chapel.
We build a chapel right here.
Who's we?
You.
Lots of luck, Mother. I ain't building no chapel.
Yeah, you.
Not only am I ain't building no chapel, I'm taking off. I ain't no contractor.
That is for the beginning.
No. I don't need all that work. No.
No?
No.
All right.
All right.
We build it. Uh-huh. We women. We build it.
You do that little thing.
We will. Oh. It's God's will.
Boy, look, I'm checking out.
Each film chosen for the series, Stagecoach, Lilies of the Field, the 1976 rendition of A Star is Born, Midnight Run, and Raising Arizona, is iconic in its own way. The screenings will take place one Saturday morning a month until October. Each film is accompanied by a discussion moderated by Jeannie Berg, a film professor at Glendale Community College. You can see Lilies of the Field tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. at the Peoria Center for the Performing Arts. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. A reminder, if you want to keep up with the show on social media, you can follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayana Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.